And it was simply this, that mankind tends to reproduce itself at a geometric rate. And that even in an age of invention and discovery, the means of support tend to reproduce themselves only at an arithmetic rate. Briefly, human society is always pushing beyond the boundaries of the capacity of the earth to provide for our communities. Majority of men who have ever lived, and according to Malthus, who will ever live, have lived lives which were signaled by the fact that they were undernourished, that they lacked enough to survive, that the only ways in which mankind had to deal with these problems were through warfare, through brutality, through getting living room, Lebensraum, at the expense of some other society. Barring natural catastrophes, barring famine, barring war, human societies reproduce themselves beyond the capacity of the environment to provide for that society. And when one adds to this observation, which comes from a period before the medical explosion of the last century or century and a half, the new techniques of modern medicine, which have reduced the dangers of infant mortality by prodigious numbers, which have reduced the numbers of young people, infants and children who die before they reach maturity through immunization and other great medical miracles, which have prolonged our lives, doubled our lifespan. And one can see that there has been an explosion of human beings, of population. And apparently, in many parts of the world, societies simply cannot provide the wherewithal, the simple basic requirements of food and shelter and support in order to provide for these societies. Once upon a time, in our grandparents' generation, of every five children who were born, two would not reach the age of six. A third would not reach 21. A fourth would die before he was 40. Today, when children are born, they have a life expectancy in the 70s. And today, there are more live births. And so we are faced by the specter of an overpopulated world, too many mouths to feed. And it is obvious to all of us that birth control, in some form or other, is a necessity for the survival of mankind. This goes, it seems to me, without saying. Birth control provides us a means of checking the population explosion short of war, short of famine, by using our minds rather than our guns and our bombs. It is obviously a good. It is obviously an important tool provided to us by modern medical technology. But is it always an ever good? Is birth control an absolute value? That's the question I'd like to lay before us today. And to ask this question from the point of view not of the sociologist or of the demographer, the expert in population, or of the historian, but from our own sociological matrix, from where we are, as Americans, as Jews, as people alive at this point, in this place, at this time. Obviously, birth control is not an absolute value. If it were, there'd be no more births. And the population would simply age, and then human society would disappear. Now, given what mankind tends to do with its societies, this may not be the ultimate tragedy. But for us, it would be a tragedy. We live in hope. And so I take it as axiomatic that we are interested in the survival of the human race. That we're not talking about an absolute ban on procreation. We're talking within certain parameters and certain limits. And the question is, what are those limits? What are the legitimate means of birth control? Which are those which are somewhat suspect? What should be our attitude towards children? If children are not the ultimate fulfillment of one generation, and if one does not measure any longer one's service to mankind by the number of sons one raises up, what is a child? Is a child an enemy? Something to be feared? A mouth to feed, an unnecessary mouth to feed, and to clothe, and to pay for an expensive education? What is a child? To a modern American, to a Jew, in 1972. Shall we simply bless the birth of a child? Shall we curse the birth of a child? How shall we look on our own roles as parents or grandparents or potential parents? That's the question that I'd like to place this morning. And perhaps the best way to begin is in my own office. She's young, she's quite good looking, vivacious, able. And she's sitting in my office next to a young man whose ring she'll be wearing in a matter of a few weeks. We talk about this and that. Then I ask about the future, what kind of home they're planning, where they plan to live, do they plan to have a family? And she answers. 10 years ago, he would answer. Now she answers. And her answer is very quick, and it's very direct and to the point. Children, no. There are already too many children. I don't want to be tied down. I want to be free. I didn't get a college education in order to train myself to be a nurse and to be a chauffeur. No children. Generally, he looks a little bit abashed, but he's in love. What can he do? Now, we've raised our children to be afraid of this population explosion. We've taught them that it is no longer true that a child is the fulfillment of a family, of a marriage. We've taught them to be afraid of overpopulation, of overbreeding. We've taught them to believe that one can live a full and complete life, a good life, a fulfilling life, without children underfoot. And more than this, many of them, particularly the young women, have become convinced that much in our society is a great conspiracy against them. The romanticization of childhood, of motherhood, is a male chauvinist big lie designed to convince them that they ought not to compete openly and on equal terms with the man, that they are biologically precluded from this. They have another function, a more glamorous function, a more divine function, reproduction. That this is their world. Let them stay out of the man's world. This is their function, and this is their future. Now, when children were necessary to the survival of the clan, When a son was a helping hand and not a hungry mouth, when a daughter was needed for the complex and complicated work of homemaking, when everything wasn't prepackaged, neat, small, clean, and mechanized, there may have been truth to this. But several generations ago, our parents and grandparents and those in charge of the strategies of our national life determined that education was to be an equal opportunity enterprise, that we were going to educate men and women in the same classroom, in the same curricula, assuming that they had the same kinds of functions in life. And you can't train a woman to use her mind and her skills to learn the law, to become a competent medical practitioner, to think in terms of a political future, and suddenly at the end of a long education, turn off opportunity and say to her, for the next 15 years, we insist that you live in a world of illiterates and semi-literates, that you spend your time changing diapers and making pabulum and cleaning the dishes and cleaning the house. The husband will go out and do the work, and this is your task. The romanticization of infancy, of childhood, of cuddling the child in the arm, has simply been shorn and ripped to shreds in our society. And then medicine has given us means of contraception, particularly the pill, which have allowed the sexual responses of people no longer to be overlaid with a sicklied fear of unwanted pregnancy. One can have a total marriage relationship without the fear of an unwanted child or children. Families can be planned, children can be spaced, and our children have been raised to expect to be able to program their children much as they schedule their education. If they want children, they will have them at a particular moment in their lives when they are most wanted, not simply when they happen to drop from the sky. Finally, most of all, we've now looked upon marriage not as a relationship in which there is a division of work, of labor. The world out there is the man's world. The world in here, behind the door, is largely the responsibility of the mother. Each is a partner, or expects to be. Very few young people go into marriage any longer programmed as their grandmothers were programmed. You know, Kinder, Kuchen, Kirch. Children, the cooking, and the work of the church, of the synagogue. They have much higher expectations of themselves, and frankly, an infant often gets in the way of those expectations. So if you add woman's lib to the pill, if you add the population to woman's lib and to the pill, you have a totally new attitude on the part of the young lady in my office, this generation, to childbearing, to marriage, to their responsibilities as to the reproduction of the human race. And I would add one other thing, and I don't mean this to be to seem trivial. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, a parent could expect respect and honor from their children. Not always, but there was authority within the home. And a child tended to be obedient because there was authority in the whole cultural ethos, in the air of the society. These young people who are now coming to be married have given their parents 1,000 headaches and heartaches and know it. They have been taught from the very beginning the importance of being free, of doing their own thing, of going their own way. Authority, in any old-fashioned sense, was thoroughly absent from their homes. And having seen the anguish, the heartache, the ulcers, the gray hair that they caused their parents, they know that the joys of parenthood are a myth. That after the age of one or two, it's work and anguish and heartache and not joy. And it's an expensive undertaking today with very little in return. Two, three generations ago, a child went to work in the family store, in the family factory, as an apprentice, as a maid in the home at the age of 8 or 9 or 10, and in a sense paid for its keep. Today you can be paying for a child's keep till he's 30, if he's going to be a neurosurgeon till he's 35 or 40. It's a different world. And having seen from within the fallacy of the myth of the joys of being a parent in the 20th century, they're not quite as eager to accept these joys for themselves. Now that's the world to which I address myself. It's a world which assumes the virtue, the validity of birth control. I do too. But I think there's some questions that we ought to ask. Are all forms of birth control equally valid? Isn't there a difference in one's judgment about the prevention of conception and one's judgment about the taking of life in some developmental stage, abortion? There are discriminations that must be made. If one takes a life in self-defense, it's not a crime. If one takes a life willfully, it's murder. Now, obviously, it's not the same thing to abort a fetus as it is to take a life of a delivered child, but where exactly is the line to be drawn? How much different is it really? We shiver when we read of the ancient Greeks who didn't have the surgical skills at our fingertips in order to abort surgically an unwanted birth, who would take the newly delivered child if it was malformed or deformed, or if it was a girl, because girls were relatively useless and undervalued in that society, and simply expose the child on the hillside. We call that infanticide. And we're indignant when we read about it. But how different really is it than the taking of life in one of its embryonic stages? There's already something called life. Now, I know that one of the planks of modern political liberalism-radicalism has been abortion reform. And the plank has often been reduced to the formula, every woman has the right to the control of her own body. And I agree. I agree thoroughly that the restrictive abortion laws which have existed in the United States and which still tend to exist in most of the states are not only cruel but unenforceable. It is one of the self-evident facts of the human experience that if a woman doesn't want a child badly enough, she will find a way of getting rid of that child. If she's rich, and this is part of the cruelty of the present laws, she will buy an abortion. If she's poor, she'll go to a charlatan, and she'll risk all kinds of dangers because of the lack of antisepsis, the lack of proper controls, but the child will be aborted. A woman must have the right in our society to make the ultimate decision with her husband, if she has one, as to whether or not she will go through to term with the birth of a child. But must not we approach that kind of decision in a mood of prayerful judgment far more sober than we do that which approaches a simple questions of the pill, of birth control, the spacing of a child, or the avoidance of having a child in the first place? There is something important about the sanctity of human life. Now, I know that it seems perhaps irrelevant in the world where we can dump millions of pounds of bombs in Vietnam the same day that I am speaking from this pulpit about the sanctity of life, about the dangers of becoming coarsened as to our value about life when we're dealing with abortion. And yet somehow the sensitivities on which civilization is based, are based, must be preserved. It is a fact that in our Jewish law, the traditional Jewish law, abortion was permitted only when there was a direct threat to the life of the mother. There were good reasons, in other words, in the minds of the ancient sages, not to make abortion, you know, easy, open, free, an accepted means of birth control. Now, I think we've gone beyond the time when any outside authority should impose its will on the mother who's actually carrying the embryo. At the same time, she must face these problems, I think, in a spirit of concern and prayerful judgment. These are not easy issues. Life is sacred. Life is not created simply at the instant when the baby is delivered. It has been in existence since conception in one way or another. Now, all abortion, every abortion is not an act of murder, as some Catholic theologians would have it. If so, God would be the supreme murderer, because most abortions are purely natural things. At the same time, must we not train ourselves to respect life? For if we do not respect life before birth, how much respect will we have for life after birth? By the same logic, can we not argue that if a child is unwanted at 3 months, 6 months, the child may not be wanted 6 months after birth, or 3 months after birth? These are difficult questions. But they certainly suggest some of the gradations, the kinds of judgment that we are going to have to face. Now, certainly I would not argue that we need more children in this world. Certainly I would not argue that a woman should not have the right to make the basic decisions governing her body. Certainly I would not argue that given the great advances of medical science, we ought not to use these to our advantage, to enhance the quality, the possibilities of human life. Certainly, I would not argue that there are many women who ought not to be mothers, and who, for whatever reasons that they give themselves, really are doing a kinder thing to life if they abort it, they avoid it, new birth, than if they come along with a lot of children they are totally disinterested in loving and caring for. At the same time, I would suggest to you that birth control is not an absolute value, and that we must bring certain sensitivities to it, certain discriminations, which I'm afraid many of us are not at the moment bringing. Let me suggest to you what some of these areas may be. About 5-6 years ago, a number of rather sensational popular science books appeared on the market: The Baby Bomb, Famine 1995, horrible predictions of what life would be like in the world, in our country, if we didn't begin to take coercive and determined political measures in order to staunch the population explosion, the baby boom. Now there are 3 billion and a few people in this world. And there are 1 billion earthlings who go to bed hungry every night. There are already in many societies too many people and too many children. And one of the interesting things that we must conjure with is the fact that there is Bangladesh and there is Australia. There is India and there is Canada. There are places, in other words, which are already overpopulated, and there are countries which are still terribly underpopulated. And that the problem of birth control is a quite different one, depending on what place one is judging the problem from. And not only are there different countries, but each country, society, is at a different stage in the control or the non-control of population. When we speak of the population explosion, generally we throw together all of the figures from all over the world. And the figures from Africa and from Latin America and from Asia are horrendous. But Japan has had effective zero population growth for 20 years. There's some very strange things are happening in the American society. After the 1960 census, when the sociologists began to extrapolate from the baby boom of the 1950s, they began to speak to us of a country which would have perhaps 350, 360 million people by the year 2000, and maybe 450 million people by the year 2020. And we began to see America turned into an India. But when the population figures of the census of 1970 were released, we discovered some interesting things. The birth rate in these United States had dropped consistently and at an increasing rate ever since 1958. And when one began to extrapolate figures from the 1970 census, it was altogether possible to extrapolate figures of this order, that by the year 2000, these United States would have a population of 250 million, and by the year 2020, we would have a population of 264 million. Now, if anyone has driven from Cleveland west to the Pacific coast, you know this is a relatively empty land. And a population of 250 million or 264 million in the next 60 years is not one which should cause us to go to bed sleepless at night. It is a population which can be managed, provided for with decency and grace and amenity in this great and broad and abundant country. The urgency, in other words, of birth control is one thing in Asia, and quite another in the United States. And the voluntary impact of the new medical science, of the pill, of all kinds of contraceptive devices, of freer abortion abilities, capacities, clinics, all of these have brought about a dramatic change in the rate of population growth in the United States, in Japan, and incidentally in almost all of Europe, especially in Eastern Europe and in Scandinavia. In other words, in the most advanced countries, a kind of voluntary checks and balance system has come into being. The woman who doesn't want a child doesn't have to have a child. The woman who feels that she cannot at this moment manage to bring her pregnancy to its full term to deliver the child doesn't deliver the child. We have voluntarily found ways to restrict the growth of population in the more advanced, technologically advanced societies, in part because we have the techniques to do it, and in part because all of us are operating with a new set of ideas about parents and children. In the primitive societies, in Eastern Europe, in the shtetl, Your grandfather and your great-grandfather had 7, 8, 9, 10 children. Why? Not because he was simply fulfilling the biblical command, be fruitful and multiply, but because without children, the business couldn't survive. He couldn't hire people. He needed sons. And mother needed daughters in the home to cook and to sew and to provide and to care and to clean. And they knew that if they had 7 children, 2, 3 of them would die in childbirth. 2, 3 of them would die from infectious diseases while they were young or in their teenagers. Only 1 or 2 would grow up to maturity to return to them the strength and the hours of work and labor which they needed. That's no longer true. The situation is reversed. It's terribly, terribly expensive in these United States to have a child. Not only is the medical care expensive, but the education is even more expensive. And then the children do what? They're no longer family businesses. They grow up and they grow away, and they're another set of expenses. As grandparents, to go and see the grandchildren. As grandparents, to telephone. How are they, you know? There's no income from children. And that simple fact has changed the Western attitudes in a very, very dramatic and visible, measurable way. So whether or not coercive measures, tax measures, or other measures of other kind are necessary to limit birth in the West is a very problematic matter indeed. And the tragedy of life 1972 is that the East and the South, Latin America, Africa, Asia, lacks yet the medical capacity, the birth control clinics, the level of education, which would allow them to make use of the devices which are available. Enough money to provide for the simplest kinds of devices. The pill costs money to take advantage of what we enjoy. And so the population explosion is taking place in the third world. And it's a particular and peculiar kind of population explosion. And this again suggests why we ought not to have necessarily have the same ideas about children that somebody in India may have. We have schools aplenty. There are nurses, there are doctors, there are recreational facilities, there are libraries, there are schools, there are synagogues, there are lawyers, there are parents, there are surrogate parents, there are courts. We have a civilized infrastructure. We can train up a child in the way that child can go. But in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, in Southeast Asia, in North Africa, Central Africa, what do we have? We have a society of the poor, with a very, very small layer of technicians, engineers, school teachers, physicians at the top. We have a society largely of semi-literates or illiterates. Uthant, who once was the Secretary General of the United Nations, as you recall, made a speech a year and a half ago in which he gave the figure of 783 million total illiterates in our world. And that the number of total illiterates in our world was increasing at a rate between 2 and 5 million a year. Now, of that 785 or 800 million, I don't know how anyone actually measures the figure, 3/4 of them exist in this other world, in this third world. And they represent 2/3 of the third world, of this other world. Now, to bring a child into a technical century in an overpopulated land where 2, 3, and 4 go to bed every night without enough in their stomachs, where there's very little opportunity for schooling, no opportunity really for any sizable percentage of the population to take advantage of the knowledge required to live in this complicated age, is one thing. And to bring a child into the world in a society such as ours, which has this infrastructure, I submit to you, is quite another. And I would submit to you one further thing, that just as we have recognized in the last 10 or 15 years that the advanced parts of the world will have to export capital, know-how, to the underdeveloped world in large amounts, if we're going to make any attempt to close the what is now an increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots, between the rich and the poor, between those who can read and those who can't read, so I suspect for a generation or two at least, we're going to have to export sizable numbers of our young and not so young, of our trained, to provide the doctors, to provide the technicians, to provide the school teachers, and the agronomists, and the economists, all these highly trained people who can at least begin to train those who live in Egypt, those who live in Bangladesh, those who live in Algerian countries whose standard of living is falling because of the population boom, to take advantage of the opportunities which science and technology and medicine now place within our reach. It may be that for a very brief time, if America, England, Scandinavia, the Eastern European countries are willing to export, not for political gain, but for social purpose, large numbers of professionals and semi-professionals, we will be doing great, great service for the rest of the world. And obviously, in order to be able to do that, we have to have young people and we have to have children. It's a strange thing. It's a paradox, if you will. Birth control is the cause and the lifestyle of those who really need it least. And birth control is often denied politically or religiously, certainly by ignorance, to those who need it the most. Now, what about overpopulation? Do you remember, well, what was it, 5-6 years ago, the Rockefeller Institute in New York did a series of studies on rat populations in a fixed, steady environment. And they showed that if you kept the rats in a particular kind of environment and they multiplied as all animals do, they gradually pushed against the limits of the food supply and then they became quite violent and vicious with each other. And after a while, a number were maddened and a greater number fell into a kind of catatonic paralysis. And we extrapolated from that to our own experience with our own cities. And we said, this is what's happening to us here in America. Look at our cities. They were once livable. They're now jungles. We're afraid to go out. There's so much viciousness. There's a murder every day in Cleveland. It's the fault of overpopulation. How can I bring a child, you know, into a world which is already at this stage? But what's to be said about this? In the first instance, human beings aren't rats. We can learn certain civilized skills. In the second instance, we must ask ourselves whether the analogy we're making is a valid one. Is overcrowding in our cities, in our country, really the cause of violence in our communities? A strange fact. Facts have a way of being very strange and puncturing some of our most cherished generalizations. In the United States, the density of population is on an average 60 per square mile. In Holland, the density of population is on the order of 960 per square mile. In Denmark, the density of population is on the order of 920 per square mile. Now, America would have to have a population reaching the billion mark before we even began to approximate such concentration of population. Now, the Danes and the Dutch have obviously learned to live together in community without violence. They're noted for that, which suggests to me that it's not overcrowding in our cities which brings out the violence among us, but the uncivilized nature of our lives. Americans have simply refused to learn the arts, the disciplines of community. We act as if we're still on the frontier with every man with a gun on his hip, able to, you know, shoot his way to his will. Manners, neighborliness, cleanliness. We're the most littering, garbage-filling society in the face of the earth. Decency, a sense of worth and of the worth of another. These things which the people of the small countries of Europe have managed to learn over many centuries, Americans have yet to learn. We're always elbowing ourselves ahead, we're always pushing somebody else out of the way, and we wonder when they get vicious in return. There is violence in our cities. The fault is not yet the overcrowding of our cities. The fault is the fault of the people who live there, who simply can't manage to live with a sense of openness and neighborliness and community. Should we have children? Should our children have children? That's really the question I've been pointing towards all morning. And my answer would be yes, and yes again. We don't need very large families, obviously. 10, 12 children, who can afford it? It's not cheaper by the dozen. And yet the world, in a very real sense, needs our families. For this moment in time, we are the parents, or the potential parents, who can offer our children the richest of opportunity. Our society simply has it. It's available. It's there. Health, food, exercise, medical care, recreation, learning. It's all there. Many societies can't offer that. Now, our world is going to need the trained mind, the skilled brain, the well-developed and strong body. We haven't yet come to the point where having a child is a sinful thing. And from this particular vantage point, America, 1970, it's still good to have children. It's demanding. It's going to demand of our young families attitudes towards themselves and towards their children, which their parents and grandparents didn't have to undertake. There's an equation, a tension here, which they must balance out, which a grandparent didn't have to balance out. How to be oneself and yet a mother. How to be a free woman, a liberated woman, and yet give time, the attention, and the love that's necessary to a child. And in the society, there are going to be many women who ought not to have children, who are so self-involved, so much taken up with the glamour of being liberated, that if they had children, they wouldn't spend the time or the attention on the child. And there are going to be husband and wife relationships which simply cannot manage the tensions which now have come into being because the husband must share in the routines of the home, even as the wife shares in the routines of bringing in a weekly paycheck. It's not going to be easy. And it's certainly not imperative that every family have children. And I guess if I'm speaking to this audience, many of whom are grandparents, my message for the morning would simply be, don't nudge. Your children know better than you do whether they can manage children or not. On the other hand, there's something very dangerous in all of this talk about birth control and the unwanted child, about this, you know, this line that's so popular now, every child a wanted child. What's the danger in it? The danger in it is that we tend to expect too much of a special child. We waited, we planned, we spaced, we did everything right. How did we get this monster? And the pressures on the child who is planned for are infinitely more than the pressures on the child who simply happens to come. We invest everything in the one, and if the one doesn't satisfy us, what other chance do we have? And there's also something dangerous in my mind about the concept of parenthood as a form of social engineering, where we make all of our judgments about children in a rather callous Rand Corporation mentality kind of way. I want this child at this time, he must be a boy, and we're ready for him now and not 6 months from now and not 6 months before. Because that's not very far from the set of mind which is the mind of the eugenicist, the person who's eager to manage birth in order to breed a better race of human beings. And we breed cattle. But when you begin to breed human beings, you're making certain a priori judgments about what's better in human beings. Blonde hair, blue eyes, an Aryan nose. That's obviously better. It was better to the German eugenicists. How do we know what's better? How does one measure it? And not being able to measure these ultimate questions of value. This particular area is one that parents, and scientists, and politicians had really best stay away from. It's an ultimate freedom, which we ought not to bargain away. And I would add this. Speaking from this pulpit to a congregation of Jews, given this environment, this open land, speaking to you here in these United States at this moment in time, I think it's not only not sinful for young Jews to have children, but that it's imperative that they do. During the 1940s, an 11th commandment was added to the obligations which rest upon us as children of Israel. Thou shalt not allow Hitler a posthumous victory. Hitler set out to destroy the Jewish people, and he very nearly succeeded. Of the 11 million Jews on the European continent in 1939, 6 million, 6 out of every 11, met their death. We have been decimated. And unless we are willing simply to phase out this great historic experience, unless we feel that Jewish creativity is at an end, that we have nothing more to offer to the world, unless we believe that this peculiar religious mission which has been ours is now complete, there is need for numbers. Once the society falls below a certain number, it not only ceases to have influence, it ultimately ceases to be. Jewish history is filled with the history of diaspora communities which simply disappeared. We've only to look at the small towns in the United States to see this process in action. 50 Jewish families in a small town. How long do they last? How much intermarriage is there in the first generation, in the second generation? By the third generation, there are a few Jewish names, a few memories, and that's all. Here, there, everywhere on the globe, there are the relics of communities which have simply disappeared, and not always because of persecution, largely because they were not numerous enough from the beginning to replenish themselves and to survive. Now, in these United States, we have half the Jewish population of the world, nearly. We have opportunity. We are well off. Most Jewish parents could provide for a sizable number of children. But in these United States, at this moment in time, we are seeing assimilation. There are high rates of intermarriage, and many of these and their children will be entirely lost to the Jewish community. And those of us who are committed, doubly so since Hitler, to the survival of this polity, and all that we stand for in realistic terms and symbolically, seems to me have a peculiar response to make to this whole question of birth control. We must control a few more births than perhaps the average within our population. We must be willing to make a few more, a much larger economic sacrifice in order to have the children and to sustain them. We must do a far better job than we are doing in order to train them up, to value the tradition which is ours and would be theirs. It's very easy for a community simply to be overwhelmed, to assimilate and to disappear. There's a very real threat that will happen in time. Israel will survive because it's a compact national state. Largely, the people whom young Israelis meet are other Israelis. Jew meets Jew, Jew marries Jew, Jew reproduces. But the diaspora is necessary to the survival of Israel. We are its ultimate second line of defense, its resource of people, its resource of international political power, for whatever value that is. We need young Jews. And strangely, and again paradoxically, it's peculiarly among the Jewish middle-class youth. The whole dogma of total birth control has been widest spread. Our birth rates in this United States over the last 15 years has been somewhat lower than that of other middle-class groups in the United States. Young person after young person who comes to me, far more, I think, than those who would come to some of the mainline Protestant churchmen in this city, say to me, for children, not for me. I want to do my thing. I want to go out and make my way. I want to make my contribution to the world. I'm glad they do, but there's also a contribution to be made at home. And it's always somewhat easier to think of oneself in a position of power, manipulating and managing others, than it is to see oneself in that delicate situation, which is that of a parent, where there are no guarantees, and where it is so very difficult in order to achieve results. Finally, what are those who say, I can't bring a child into this world of violence, filth, dirt, war, racism, hate? My world has always known convulsion. What am I offering this child? How can I think of having a child now that there are the means available not to have? To those of little faith, I would tell them an Agada from our Talmud about King Hezekiah, the last king of Judah, an honorable man who, according to tradition, was blessed with foresight, power of prophecy, and about the prophet Isaiah, who preached in the court of Hezekiah. Hezekiah alone among the kings of Israel is reported never to have had a child. And this imaginary story imagines the conversation between Isaiah and Hezekiah, in which Isaiah says to Hezekiah, how could you, as a righteous man, not have children? Isn't the first law of the Bible, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth? And Hezekiah's answer to Isaiah was simply this. You know, I have the power of clear vision of prophecy. And I foresaw that my children would sin. And Isaiah said to him, what have you with the mysteries of God? Do what is commanded of you, and leave God to take care of that which is his. Which is a legendary way of saying this. This may seem to some the most dangerous of all possible worlds, but it may be at the same time the most open and hopeful of all possible worlds. Our tradition always spoke of the coming of the Messiah as being predated by the birth pangs of the Messiah, the travails, the anguish, the convulsion. It is always darkest just before the dawn. Now, I don't guarantee that there is a dawn, that there is an end to war, to the tensions of our world. But I would say this. Children can be brought into this world with as much confidence as they have been brought into any generation that man has ever known. We can offer them much, including, most importantly of all, an opportunity to live at a time when the society will have need of sensitive men and women of skill, and when there's a real chance to use some magnificent new technology, new discovery, new power for the good of all, to make substantial changes in the context and nature of human life. The first law of the Bible is to be fruitful, multiply, and to replenish the earth. We don't have to be quite as fruitful as our fathers, nor to multiply with the same geometric power. We need to replenish the earth with Jews, with good Jews. We have a unique opportunity to do so. Amen.